Well, one of the toughest problems mankind faces is pride. Not that the world, of course, bothers to think about that subject as we in the church do. In the world, it's generally applauded. It's encouraged, even, that is, pride. But for those called by God to become as He is, to become like Him, pride is as destructive as it gets. Pride is really a very bad thing. And I think we all are aware of that. Pride destroys holy character as it destroys godly relationships with church members, between church members, as well as our spiritual relationship with God Himself. Now, we humans, as we know, are flesh, and thus we're weak and we're flawed. That's the way we were made by God. So we would learn to overcome, learn to grow in strength past those weaknesses and sin, that is the breaking of God's law, so that once godly character is built to the point and it's set in us, in other words, like God said about Abraham when Isaac was going to be sacrificed, He said, "Now I know you. Now I know what you will do under the most trying of circumstances." So Abraham's character was to the point where God knew that he could count on him and having that type of character. So when we've reached that point where our character is set, then of course we continue as long as God gives us breath until we're transformed into the eternal children of God through the resurrection according to His plan. And we all are avid followers of that line of thinking because we certainly want to be there, don't we, when that resurrection occurs and the other resurrections as well. But God provides even more insight into the origins of pride because that's where I'm going today. Well, let's take a brief look at what I'm talking about. Isaiah chapter 14. Isaiah chapter 14. Here we go. Isaiah chapter 14, beginning in verse 11. Isaiah chapter 14 and verse 11, beginning there. "Your pomp," that is, if you look that up, that means your pride, your arrogancy, "is brought down to Sheol, and the sound of your stringed instruments. The maggot is spread under you, and worms cover you." Now, this is a reference to the end of man, but it also is a a type of reference to Satan's end as well. Verse 12, "How you are fallen," that is, cast down and thrown out. So he didn't just slip and fall, he was tossed from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. "How you're cut down to the ground, you who weaken the nations." He was on this world long before mankind was created. But later on, when mankind was created, he was doing that weakening referred to here. Verse 13, "For you've said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit in the mount of the congregation on the farthest sides of the north." And you'll recall, who is it that sits on the mount of the congregation on the farthest sides of the north? Well, it's God the Father. That's where He sits. That's where His throne is. So Lucifer, who rebelled and became the one we call Satan, he said, "I'll ascend into heaven. I'll exalt my throne above the stars of God, above all the angelic hosts." And he goes on further, "I will also sit on the mount of the congregation on the farther sides of the north." Well, there's only one problem with that. There's room for a being there, not another one. In verse 14, "I will ascend above the height of the clouds," referring to his throne was on this world at that time. "I will be like the Most High." So not like is not what he had in mind. I will replace the Most High. That's what Satan had in mind. When he changed, let's go to Ezekiel, get a little more detail here. Ezekiel chapter 28. Ezekiel chapter 28, and beginning in verse 12. None of these are new scriptures. In fact, none of these scriptures in the book are new, are they? But Ezekiel 28, beginning in verse 12. Son of man, take up a lamentation for the king of Tyre, a likeness to Satan. King of Tyre was a human, but that's not what he's talking about here, as you can read on and see. But it is a reference to Satan. And say to him, thus says the Lord God, you were the seal of perfection. Obviously, no king of Tyre was the seal of perfection, but Lucifer was. God said so. In other words, he wasn't only perfect, he was the seal of perfection. Full of wisdom and perfect in beauty, filled up in wisdom. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering, the sardius, topaz, diamond, beryl, onyx, jasper, sapphire, turquoise, emerald with gold. The workmanship of your timbrels and pipes was prepared for you on the day you were created. So those things were created perfectly. And then when he was created perfectly. You were the anointed cherub who covers. Now, the Bible speaks either specifically or in more general terms about archangels, cherubs. And you'll notice here it says not only was he a cherub, as were a couple of others that we can think of, but he was set apart. It doesn't say that about the other ones. He was set apart. So he was given even special status over and above. He said, God says, I established you. We're in verse 14. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked back and forth in the midst of the fiery stones. You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created till iniquity was found in you. Verse 16, by the abundance of your trading, and, you know, we don't have a clear understanding of what the trading is here or the reference to that, but the abundance of it, you became filled with violence within, and you sinned. In other words, you broke my law. Therefore, I cast you as a profane thing, and profane simply means common. You were the sum seal of perfection until iniquity was found in you, and then you were common. You were nothing compared to anything that I created you to be. Therefore, I cast you as a profane thing out of the mountain of God, and I destroyed you. In other words, I took away from you all that ever was from me. O covering cherub, from the midst of the fiery stone. Verse 17, your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. I cast you to the ground. I laid you before kings that they might gaze at you. And see, that time hasn't happened yet. The kings that this is referring to are not the kings after he was tossed out of heaven that came to be kings. They've not seen Satan. This is a reference to the future when those in the resurrection who will be kings and priests, they will see him. They will see him in this condition here. But he says, your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. And this isn't just talking about his physical beauty, the physical, well, spiritual beauty, if I may say that. His form, his shape, his glorious coverings, all of those beautiful, wonderful things certainly were there. But the beauty being referred to here is not only that, but the beauty of the sum total of being the seal of wisdom, of being the total or the totality of perfection. That is a beauty all of its own. So your heart was lifted up because you were in the vernacular, you were wonderful. You were beyond anything ever had been to that time. So this is where pride originated. It originated with Lucifer, who became Satan. The first being to experience that was him. And he reveled in it. He grew in it. He loved it. It's who he was, to the point where he wanted to toss out God the Father and become the Most High. All because of him letting that urge within him to be something that he was never intended to be. He was going to grasp it for himself. That pride that blossomed in his heart because he was so wonderful. He couldn't imagine anyone else not thinking that he was the best that there ever was and would be. But that's where it originated. So pride is a satanic commodity. It's not anything to be, you know, even vaguely proud of, if I can use that term proud, when I'm talking about pride. But Satan inspires pride in all humans, day and night, all of our lives. Now, I'm not saying that what he inspires necessarily bears fruit all the time. I'm just saying that he's continually broadcasting that attitude. Because if there's one thing about Satan that you can say that he is full of, and that is pride. It's insidious. And if we open our hearts to it, it will consume us as it did Lucifer. Lucifer is now Satan, who is now nothing of what God intended him to be and what he had the potential to be and become. And we can end up the same way, is my point. But, you know, God gives us a lot of room in the scriptures about the subject of pride and how destructive it is. We can think of many other scriptures as well that talk about that, and you've read plenty of them, I'm sure. Now, this next scripture can be applied to any sin that I'm going to bring up, but it most certainly applies to the sin of pride. It's a key scripture in what we will be covering in this sermon. Let's turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and beginning in verse 11. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, beginning in verse 11, 11 through 13. Now, all these things happened to them, talking about those who lived before that God worked with and dealt with. Now, all these things happened to them as examples. And they were written for our admonition. And our admonition here means this is being called to our attention. We are seeing this as a possible rebuke, as a warning. So they were written for our warning, a call to attention, upon whom the end of the ages have come. Verse 12, therefore let him who thinks he stands, take heed, lest he fall, because that's the way pride is. We can't imagine that we aren't wonderful and that we stand tall. And in actual fact, that isn't the case. That's what it's talking about here. Verse 13, no temptation, that is, testing, has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tested beyond what you are able. But with testing, he will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. So, any trial in life, any test in life, he's saying that God is merciful and he will work with us and help us to work our way through it. Even pride. He makes no differentiation between the different sins, even in pride. So this applies here that the life examples left to us in the scriptures by those that have lived before us that God dealt with, whether it was ancient Israel or any one of the number of people that God dealt with, along with Christians down since, those examples are there for our warning. Because we can learn spiritual lessons from them, and that's what we should do. One of the things we should be doing in our Bible study is looking at it from the standpoint of folks, people, what's happened to them, what they do, what they think, what they say. So in the context of pride, we're told to be careful because thinking we stand, we're obviously not going to. We're going to fall eventually. And then it talks of tests in connection with our attitude. So this is all kind of a prelude to talking about these examples of pride. So today we'll look into the lives of some of Judah's righteous kings and learn lessons from their problems and sins of pride. Now, we could have went anywhere with this, all sorts of different people, but it's interesting, I find, that a number of these kings in Judah, after the breakup, after the split between Israel and Judah, were righteous in terms of what God saw and the way he looked at them. So the sermon title is, What Can We Learn from Examples of Pride? What can we learn from examples of pride? Now, the first one that I have here is Uzziah, or Uzziah, depending on how you pronounce it. One of the kings. I'm going to just give you this one reference here. We're not going to turn there, but this is for the context. This, you can read it and get the background if you like. I'll touch on what that is. 2 Chronicles 26, the first 15 verses. 2 Chronicles 26, 1 through 15. Again, we're not going to turn there. But basically, what it is Uzziah did what was right in God's sight. He sought God. God strengthened him militarily so that he was able to subdue all of his enemies around him. And they brought tribute to Uzziah. He was wealthy, and he made Judah very, very strong. So let's go to 2 Chronicles, though, chapter 26. And I want to look starting in verse 15. 2 Chronicles 26. 2 Chronicles 26 and beginning in verse 15. Now, talking about Uzziah, of course, kind of breaking into the thought, but nevertheless, and he made, talking about the king, devices in Jerusalem invented by skillful men. But see, he had the cleverness to apply these clever and these wonderful machines for Judah's sake. But they were invented by skillful men to be on the towers and corners, to shoot arrows and large stones. So he had a very effective artillery setup going on in his fortified cities and other places like that. So his fame spread far and wide, for he was marvelously helped till he became strong. So people thought he was the stuff. I mean, look at all that he did and how he come up with all these things and applied them. And Judah grew exponentially in power. And his fame spread far and wide, like it says there in verse 15. Verse 16, but when he was strong, his heart was lifted up. And we know that that's kind of a common thing. It's not always that way. But sometimes when things are going great guns for anyone, well, God kind of gets left in the dust, and we start thinking about how wonderful we are. But when he was strong, his heart was lifted up to his destruction. For he transgressed against the Lord his God by entering the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. So Azariah the priest went in after him, and with him were 80 priests of the Lord, valiant men. And they withstood King Uzziah and said to him, It is not for you, Uzziah, to burn incense to the Lord, but for the priests, the sons of Aaron, who are consecrated to burn incense. Get out of the sanctuary. For you have trespassed. You shall have no honor from the Lord God. Verse 19. Then Uzziah became furious. His authority was being thrown back in his face. You don't have the authority here. Get out. Well, to him, he was the authority. And he said what went. So he, in verse 19, was furious, and he had a censer in his hand to burn incense, and while he was angry with the priest, leprosy broke out on his forehead, because the priest in the house of the Lord, or before the priest in the house of the Lord, beside the incense altar. And Azariah, the chief priest, and all the priests looked at him, and there on his forehead was leprous. So they had thrust him out of that place. Indeed, he also hurried to get out. I guess once he realized leprosy was there, it not only scared him, but he realized that that just didn't come by, you know, some whim. He knew that he had messed up seriously, and God was letting him know it. So he hurried to get out because the Lord had struck him. So here was a man who did great things for the country, for all the citizens, you might say, of Judah. But yet he forgot who he was. God gave him many blessings. He allowed him to be king. Many good things that he did, but it just bubbled up in him, this thing about pride. Look at me, how wonderful I am, how clever I am. I'm in charge, I'm in control, I say so, and, you know, that whole thing going. That's where pride leads you. Exactly where it led Lucifer to become Satan. So what can we learn from Uzziah's pride? Even though he walked with God, he allowed his wealth, his might, his power, in his case, an office, to lift him in pride where he, like Saul before him, King Saul, thought he could determine how he would worship God. God set it up. He said, this is the way worship service is done. The priests do this and that and the other, and no one else does. Well, he found that out the hard way. So we too can become mature members in the church. We may have an office. We may not have an office. That's really doesn't play into it all that much. But we can allow pride to cause us to overstep ourselves, to overstep whatever authority we may have, whatever responsibilities we may have, and we can overstep and determine for ourselves what we will believe, what we believe we can do, how we will worship our God. We can justify some of these things, and you all sitting here know, probably somewhere, sometime, people who have done exactly this very same thing, become more mature in the church, in the faith, and pride starts to just drift in there, maybe unbeknownst. In many cases, they're not even aware of it, but yet it takes over. And then they begin setting the boundaries of what can be done and what can't, overstepping what God says, and that is the problem. And even to the point where, like in his case, Uzziah, but even in church members at times, even to think it right to not be subject to the authority God has given others. It happens. And we need to think about that. One of the things Uzziah forgot about, God said, this is the way it's going to be. Uzziah said, it's not going to be that way. It's going to be the way I want to do it. The way that God told the priests to do it. And they stood up to him in this case. Now, another king of Judah that we'll talk about here is, so that's one area, is Josiah. And you can get all the background on him in 2 Chronicles, and we'll turn there. We're not going to read the background, but 2 Chronicles, chapters 34 and 35. So 2 Chronicles 34 and 35 have all the context material that you want. But what we are going to read is in verse 35, latter part. 2 Chronicles chapter 35. And we'll get to that reading in just a moment. But the background is that Josiah did what was right in God's sight, as David had done. He purged Judah of false worship, of the high places, where sacrifices were carried out, demon worship and all of that. Pagan altars, Baals, and images. He restored the temple, found the book of the law, decreed its obedience in all Judah, restored true worship. And he kept the Passover season basically incomparable to anything since the time of Samuel. He turned neither to the right nor to the left. That was Josiah. That's the man we read about. Very much a righteous king. But 2 Chronicles chapter 35, beginning in verse 20. 2 Chronicles chapter 35, beginning in verse 20. And after all this, when Josiah had prepared the temple, Necho, king of Egypt, the Pharaoh there, came up to fight against Carchemish by the Euphrates. And Josiah went out against Necho. Now, the background here, it's not all that important, but it does clarify a little bit of this history stuff here. There was a fortress there in that city, that fortified city, along the banks of the upper Euphrates River. And for many years, it was an important city within the Assyrian Empire. And the Babylonians, during the end of King Josiah, of Judah's reign, they attacked the Assyrian stronghold of Carchemish with the hope of finally destroying their enemy. So that was what was going on. The Babylonians were after the Assyrians. And of course, King Josiah, for whatever strange reason, he favored the Babylonians. And then, of course, he tried to stop the Egyptians from attacking the Babylonians because the Egyptians were favorable to the Assyrians. So here you have regional politics at its best, countries at each other, all of that going on. So Necho, king of Egypt, came up to fight against Carchemish by the Euphrates. Josiah went out against him. But he, that is Necho, the king, the guy down in Egypt, he sent messengers to him saying, "What have I to do with you, king of Judah? I've not come against you this day, but against the house with which I have a war. For God commanded me to make haste." Interesting. Refrain from meddling with God, who is with me, lest he destroy you. So here is the Pharaoh of Egypt telling the king of Judah, God told me to do this. He told me to make haste and come up here and do this battle that does not include you nor Judah. Now, this is a righteous king, somebody who is used to following God's law and God's will. One would think that he might have stopped where he was at, grabbed a prophet from Judah somewhere, and said, "Please inquire about this. I need to know what's going on here. I've not known anything about this." And of course, hindsight's perfect, right? Actually, it would have been even better had he, before he even left Judah, if he had just simply gone to God and say, "God, I'm going to go attack the Pharaoh coming up from Egypt. But should I do it? Is it your will? Will I win? Will I lose? Should I just stay home and let the guys over there have their day? What should I do?" He didn't do that. He went ahead on out there without consulting with God, which wasn't the best thing for him to do, obviously. But then Necho told him this, that God sent him. Now, you think that might have given him a bit of pause, but it didn't. Verse 22, "Nevertheless, Josiah would not turn his face from him, but disguised himself so that he might fight with him." I guess if they recognized him, they'd put flankers out or whatever and keep him away out of the fight, you know, because they didn't want to kill him unnecessarily, because the fight wasn't with Judah, really. But he did not heed the words of Necho from the mouth of God. And that's what the scripture here says. So he came to fight in the valley of Megiddo, and the archers, that is the Pharaoh's archers, shot King Josiah. And the king said to his servants, "You know, take me away. I'm severely wounded." They took him back to Jerusalem, and there he died and buried in the tombs of his fathers. And all Judah and Jerusalem mourned for Josiah. He was a wonderful king. He was a good man. But for whatever reason, and the reasons are probably the usual ones that prevail, Josiah allowed pride in his accomplishments, in his closeness to God, perhaps, in being a righteous king, and his office, perhaps, to blind him to the fact that everyone, no matter our station, no matter our wealth, no matter our spirituality, everyone must seek God's guidance in our daily lives. Everyone. And he forgot that. If we allow pride to make us think that God will only talk or work through us and not others, we will quickly find ourselves at cross purposes with God himself. Not a good place to be for any of us. But that was Josiah's mistake. His pride in who he was, in his, I'm sure, his closeness to God had part of it. But yet, he didn't ask God about any of this. You know, before he left, even after he got out there and got the message that God had sent Necho, he just went ahead with it. And he died. Unnecessarily, but he died. So the lesson there is, we have to seek God's guidance in our daily lives, no matter what's going on, no matter who we are or who we think we are. Third righteous king that I have here that we'll look at is Hezekiah. And most of us remember the story of Hezekiah pretty easily because of things that happened, and they're mentioned fairly often. But his background is 2 Chronicles verses 29 through 32. And you can get the story there. The Cliff Notes version is that Hezekiah did what was right in God's sight according to all that David had done. And again, you can look at this later, 2 Chronicles chapters 29 through 32. He restored the temple. He restored temple service and worship. Kept the Passover season pretty much unlike anything had been done before, at least since Solomon. And destroyed pagan worship, including the high places. And then God delivered Judah from invasion by Assyria. So all of these good things that he had going on. So where we want to go right now then is 2 Kings chapter 20. 2 Kings chapter 20. And we'll begin in verse 1. Verses 1 through 11. 2 Kings 20, beginning in verse 1. In those days, Hezekiah was sick and near death. And Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz, went to him and said to him, "Thus says the Lord, set your house in order, for you shall die and not live." Then he, Hezekiah, turned his face toward the wall and prayed to God, saying, Remember now, O Lord, I pray, how I have walked before you in truth and with a loyal heart and have done what was good in your sight. And Hezekiah wept bitterly. Verse 4, and it happened before Isaiah had gone out into the middle court that the word of the Lord came to him, saying, Return and tell Hezekiah, the leader of my people, Thus says the Lord, the God of David, your father, I've heard your prayer, I've seen your tears. Surely I will heal you. On the third day you shall go up to the house of the Lord, and I will add to your days 15 years. Now that would be pretty cool. You're right at death's door, and God has told you, I'm going to add 15 years to your life. Because he was a righteous king. He did all of these things, and he did them with a right heart. And of course, it didn't upset God's overall plan in dealing with the nation. So that's what he decided that he would do. Verse 6, I'll add to your days 15 years. Verse 7, then Isaiah said, Well, God finished up there in verse 6. He said, I'll deliver you and this city from the hand of the king of Assyria. I'll defend this city for my own sake and for the sake of my servant David. Verse 7, then Isaiah said, take a lump of figs. So they took and laid it on the boil. Apparently, Hezekiah had a boil, part of this sickness that he had. And he recovered. And Hezekiah said to Isaiah, now right here, you have to start wondering, what is going on with Hezekiah? He was sick. He was going to die. He was told he was going to die. And suddenly God reversed it based on his prayer. Okay, I'll heal you. And they put this poultice on this boil, and he recovered. But then Hezekiah said to Isaiah, what is the sign that the Lord will heal me and that I shall go up to the house of the Lord the third day? So I guess he was asking for something a little more definitive, that he wasn't going to maybe get sick again just right away. I mean, like God told him, 15 years. But he couldn't quite believe it. I'm not sure. It sounded like he couldn't believe it. So he wanted a sign that God would heal him. Then Isaiah said, this is the sign, verse 9, to you from the Lord, that the Lord will do the thing which he has spoken. Shall the shadow go forward 10 degrees or go backward 10 degrees? Talking about on the old sundial or the timepiece that uses the sun and the shadow cast. And Hezekiah answered, well, it's easy for the shadow to go down 10 degrees because it's going that way anyway. But no, let the shadow go backward 10 degrees. Like, I've thought of something really clever here. You know, something that I can really know that God is going to do what he said. And Hezekiah probably should have known that God would do what he said. So Isaiah, the prophet, in verse 11, cried out to the Lord, and he brought the shadow 10 degrees backward, by which it had gone down on the sundial of Ahaz. So the miracle was there. It was done. Hezekiah saw it. He was healed. He felt better. Now I want to take you over to this same, we're continuing on the same vein. Chronicles chapter 32. 2 Chronicles chapter 32. And when we get done reading this, I want you to keep your little finger in 2 Chronicles, because we'll jump back there. We have to do a little jumping to get the whole story, because one place fills in this and another place fills in that. So 2 Chronicles, chapter 32, and beginning in verse 24. 2 Chronicles 32, beginning in verse 24. 2 Chronicles 32, beginning in verse 24 through 26. In those days, Hezekiah was sick and near death. And he prayed to the Lord, and God spoke to him and gave him a sign. And this is kind of the, you know, a shortened version of what happened here in Chronicles. But Hezekiah did not repay according to the favor shown him, for his heart was lifted up. Now, God showed special favor to him. And it says that Hezekiah did not repay. Well, repay what? Well, how about thanksgiving for one thing? How about being graciously thankful that the supreme being of all healed you and gave you 15 more years of life? How about that? Not to mention the fact you're a king and you got all the money you need and all these other things, these wonderful things. But Hezekiah did not repay. How about Hezekiah asking for a sign when God told him that he was going to extend his life? But Hezekiah asked for a sign. So he didn't exactly repay God there according to the favor shown him. Why? Because his heart was lifted up. This is there in verse 25. For his heart was lifted up. He lost himself. He forgot who he was. He was a man that God was using as a leader of Judah, and even though he put in a lot of time doing right and good things, it grew on him. I'm king. I'm special. I can bargain with God. You know, he healed me. Okay, well, that's fine. I asked him to make the sundial go back. Well, he did that too. God does a lot of stuff for me. He and I are like this, you know. He just, whatever I say, that's. So you can see his thinking. And that lifted his heart up. In other words, pride began to blossom. Therefore, wrath was looming over him and over Judah and Jerusalem. That's verse 25. Now, somewhere along in there, he started getting a clue that he had messed up. Verse 26. Then Hezekiah humbled himself for the pride of his heart. He and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, so I guess they all felt that way, but yet they all saw what was going to happen to them because of Hezekiah's pride. And the inhabitants of Jerusalem, so that the wrath of the Lord did not come upon them in the days of Hezekiah. Almost sound like, okay, Hezekiah, I'm not going to kill you and all these people here, but later on after you're gone, I'm going to kill all them. Well, it's not really that way with God. He knew that he would not, since Hezekiah repented. He wouldn't do that then, but he knew everybody after that was going to swell up in pride like a bunch of toads in a rainstorm, and they were going to be doing that and worse. So God was going to take out Jerusalem and Judah and everybody else because, not because he was being callous towards them after Hezekiah. Not at all. So Hezekiah did ask for a sign of his healing. God gave him a choice of a sign. Hezekiah chose the sign that was promptly done by God. Then in his heart, Hezekiah lightly esteemed the whole episode by not showing graciousness and gratitude for the miracles done just for him and because of pride. He just thought it was his due, I guess. Okay, keep your finger there. 2 Chronicles 32. But I want you to flip over. We're going to catch a little piece of what happened after that over in 2 Kings 20. 2 Kings 20. 2 Kings 20. 2 Kings 20. I know it's here somewhere. 2 Kings 20. Now the whole thing will begin in verse 12 and go down to 19. But 2 Kings 20, and verse 12 is all I'm going to read right now. At that time, talking about after this transpired here with Hezekiah, at that time, Berodach, Baladan, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he heard that Hezekiah had been sick. So after he recovered, the king of Babylon sent letters and a present to Hezekiah because he'd heard he'd been sick. And for what was going on there, he was hearing these stories about these miracles. Now, keep your finger there in 2 Kings 20. And let's drop back over to 2 Chronicles chapter 32 again, where I told you to keep your finger before, if you remember. 2 Chronicles chapter 32 and verse 31. 2 Chronicles chapter 32 and verse 31. So the king of Babylon sends letters and a present to Hezekiah because he had been sick and he was hearing about these miracles. 2 Chronicles 32, 31. However, regarding the ambassadors, that's the people who brought these messages and letters and presents and all, of the princes of Babylon, whom they sent to him to inquire about the wonder that was done in the land, these miracles that were done to Hezekiah. God withdrew from him, God withdrew from Hezekiah, in order to test him that he might know all that was in his heart. So, you know, Hezekiah is a good guy, but he's doing these up and down things, and God wanted to find out where his heart really was. So he withdrew his presence from Hezekiah for a time. Back to 2 Kings, back to that chapter 20, and we'll continue. We read verse 12, then that happened in Chronicles we just read, that one thing there, that God was going to test him. Now, verse 13 in 2 Kings 20. Verse 13 of 2 Kings 20. Now, Hezekiah was attentive to them, that these ambassadors and the emissaries that the Babylonian king sent. And he showed them all the house of his treasures, the silver, gold, spices, precious ointment, his whole armory, all that was found among his treasures. There was nothing in his house or in all his dominion that Hezekiah did not show them. Okay. He's quite proud of that stuff, wasn't he? Then Isaiah the prophet went to King Hezekiah, this is verse 14, and said to him, "What did these men say, and where do they come from?" So Hezekiah said, "They come from a far country, from Babylon." Verse 15, and he said, that is Isaiah, "What have they seen in your house?" So Hezekiah answered, "Well, they've seen all that is in my house. There's nothing among my treasures that I have not shown them." Verse 16, then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, "Hear the word of the Lord. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and what your fathers have accumulated until this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord. And they'll take away some of your sons who will descend from you, whom you will beget, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon." In other words, these emissaries weren't there just to get the skinny on the miracles and everything else. They were checking out Judah as a future conquest. So God was telling him what was going to happen. Verse 19, so Hezekiah said to Isaiah, "The word of the Lord which you have spoken is good!" Exclamation point. Well, the fact that God tells any of us anything is good. But he sounded like he was excited that, you know, this bad news, he was excited about it. "For he said," Hezekiah said, "Will there not be peace and truth at least in my days?" What a guy. Daddy, I'm going to be a eunuch in this guy's palace and you're only worried about peace and truth in your days? What about my days? What are they going to be like? So Hezekiah was a righteous king, no doubt. God says that and makes that plain. But Hezekiah was up and down the scale. I mean, he was all over the place, some of the time at least. Pride. He was only concerned about himself, ultimately, at least at this time, by the time this is written here in 2 Kings 20. He was just glad there was going to be peace and truth, at least in his days. So what can we learn from Hezekiah's pride? Well, we can see that Hezekiah allowed his close relationship with God to be taken for granted, so that pride arose, causing him to think that the special miracles that God did were actually his due, that God was his buddy and he was taking care of him and he would do all these things for him. And he was correspondingly not properly grateful. And we can also see that Hezekiah took pride in his many possessions. I mean, he was proudly showing off all of Judah's wealth and everything that they had to these so-called ambassadors from a foreign nation that basically liked to kill people and take over what they had. That's what Babylon liked to do. And he did foolishly boast of all of that to their emissaries. But we can also see that God withdrew from Hezekiah during the emissaries' visits, these ambassadors when they visited, to test Hezekiah, to see what was in his mind, his heart. Now, God can look on our minds and hearts, but he wanted to see what Hezekiah would do on his own, using his own mind, using the knowledge that God had given him. I assume he had God's spirit. I don't recall one way or the other, but I assume that was the case. But God withdrew from him because he wanted Hezekiah to think it through and see what he would do. Now, he had all of God's instruction. He had God's favor. He had God's help all in the past, but that's why he withdrew. He wanted to see what he would do under those circumstances. So from this, we can see that we, as members of the church, we can also take our relationship with God for granted at times and not properly be thankful and appreciative of him. It's so easy to do. We can be that way about anything with anyone, really. But certainly we can with God, too. Especially the longer we're in the church, in some ways we, you know, you're used to it. But we can't be that way. And we can also take our physical blessings for granted, whatever they might be, to the point of taking pride in them. As though, look at what I've done here. Look what I've made of this place. Look what I've done and thought of and built and grew and invested and on and on. We can take pride in them. And it's not that we can't take satisfaction in doing good things for ourselves, for our families, but taking pride is a different thing. Pride is pride, and it's not a right thing. But if we do that as though it's our due, well, then perhaps God will need to test us to see what is in our heart, that he might withdraw from us for a period of time to see what is in our heart, what we're going to do based on everything to date that he has shown us and taught us. What are we going to do with that? Is our character going to meet that test? Now, the last king that I'm going to bring up here is a fellow by the name of Jehoshaphat. And his background is found in 2 Chronicles 17 and 18. But the context is that Jehoshaphat begins his reign following after David seeking God and walking in all his commandments. He even started removing all the high places, those places of demon worship, which many of the righteous kings, you read about them, they didn't remove the high places. He taught the people God's law. God blessed him with wealth and might. Jehoshaphat, though, you'll find in chapter 18, he was allied with Ahab of Israel through marriage. You think, well, okay, you know, you can't choose, you know, who the relatives are necessarily. That's true. But he allows himself to be persuaded by Ahab to go to war against Syria with Israel, of course, as his ally. So Jehoshaphat meets with Ahab to, you know, discuss all these things. But he wants to seek a prophet in Israel, and they could only find one. I mean, a true prophet of God. So they found him, Micaiah. And he, that prophet, predicts defeat for Israel and the death of Ahab if they go ahead with this war against Syria. So Jehoshaphat hears that from God's prophet, and then he promptly ignores the advice he sought from that prophet, and he goes with Ahab against Syria anyway. Well, what can you say? Jehoshaphat ignores that advice. Ahab is killed. Israel is scattered. Jehoshaphat makes it back to Jerusalem through God's intervention during the battle. Now, he didn't, when he went to talk to Ahab, he knew what a guy Ahab was. Ahab was not warm and fuzzy. He was not a cuddly guy. You know, he had no relationship with God whatsoever except mean, hate, whatever. So he didn't ask God about going there. When he got there and discussed this war, and he said, well, I want to have a prophet from God and ask him. And he told him what was going to happen. Well, why did he even bother? He just went ahead with Ahab anyway. So he just disregarded what God said completely. Second Chronicles chapter 19, 2 Chronicles chapter 19, verses 1 and 2. 2 Chronicles chapter 19, verses 1 and 2. Then Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, returned safely to his house in Jerusalem, as I was mentioning a bit ago. And Jehu, the son of Hanani, the seer, went out to meet him and said to King Jehoshaphat, "Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord?" Therefore, the wrath of the Lord is upon you. So despite God's blessings to Jehoshaphat, because he set his heart to obey God, he nevertheless allowed his position as king and all that he had, his authority, his might, his ability to make decisions and to rule and to lead and whatever else appealed to his vanity, he allowed all of those things to blind him to certain godly principles. He allowed his pride to cause him to think it was okay to consort with and even ally himself with those that would help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord. 2 Chronicles chapter 20, just next chapter up, beginning in verse 35. So we see this pattern that Jehoshaphat is involved in. 2 Chronicles 20, and beginning in verse 35. And after this, Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, allied himself with Ahaziah. That was a king after Ahab who got slammed, like in dead. So he allied himself with Ahaziah, king of Israel, who acted very wickedly. He didn't learn anything from what happened before, did he? Verse 36, and he allied himself with him to make ships to go to Tarshish. And they made the ships in Ezion Geber. But Eleazar, the son of Dodavah of Marsha, prophesied, he was a prophet, against Jehoshaphat, saying, "Because you have allied yourself with Ahaziah, the Lord has destroyed your works." Then the ships were wrecked, so that they were not able to go to Tarshish. So it wasn't enough that God brought his wrath on Jehoshaphat for his earlier alliance with Ahab. But then King Jehoshaphat insisted on allying himself He allied himself with another wicked king of Israel, Ahaziah. So again, God demonstrated his anger, and the joint venture from the alliance came to nothing. So here's a king, a righteous king. Why? He wanted to be one of the players. He wanted to be one of the boys. He wanted to be strong and confident and a leader. And so he wandered in there with Ahab, even though God's prophet told him it wasn't going to work out well. He ignored that, made it back, and then the prophet told him, he says, "What were you trying to do by helping a wicked king?" So, what lesson can we learn from Jehoshaphat's acts of pride? Well, simply that we can, through, even though we're living right with God, being blessed in many ways, even having our heart in the work of God today, all those things, we can still allow pride in all this, thinking that we have it together. Unfortunately, I've known a few people in the church over the years that have had that mentality. So we can still allow pride in all of this to blind us to the company we keep, whether in the church, whether out of the church, just like this king, Jehoshaphat, a righteous king of Judah. Boy, did he keep the wrong company or what? And did he ignore God when God warned him? Yeah. Twice? Yeah. Yes, he did. So we can tell ourselves that we're doing properly by going out of our way to befriend, even ally ourselves, or to get with the wrong company. And as Jehu the prophet said, help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord. So there's something in there for us as well. It's one thing to love and to help, and it's another thing. We have to use the judgment that God gives us, the wisdom that he gives us, not the pride that wells up within us that we're going to do wonderful things here. And that may have been part of the problem when he went to Ahab's, you know, a family member, quote unquote, to help him out. And this other family member, I guess he was a descendant of Ahab, the next king down the line, Ahaziah. I don't recall all the begets there, but that may have been the case. But going out of our way to befriend or ally ourselves in that way, thinking we're doing a good thing, thinking it's love, you know, that we're good, we're doing good things here, we're, you know. But we have to make that judgment that God has given us a mind to make, and that is to not help the wicked and to not love those who hate God. Doesn't mean that we, you know, run over them with our truck. It just means that we avoid folks that hate God and who are wicked. Plain and simple. So, to wrap this up, I'll just hit these points here real quick. We too can become members, mature members in the church, and we can allow our pride to cause us to overstep ourselves, to think it's right to not be subject to others, maybe in authority, that God has given that authority to. We can also allow pride to blind us in our accomplishments, maybe in office, maybe not, in the church, and that no matter our station, no matter our wealth, no matter our maturity, our growth, whatever it might be, we have to always remember that we have to seek God's guidance. He expects us to seek his guidance, his wisdom. He gives us those things, but we also have to seek him in our daily lives. Otherwise, we could find ourselves very easily cross purposes with God. And another lesson is that we can see in our pride, we can also take our relationship with God for granted and not be properly thankful or appreciative of him. We need to keep that uppermost in mind. He expects us to be there, to talk with him, and to show true appreciation to him. Our blessings, we can take those for granted. We can take pride in them as though they're expected. Well, yeah, you know, bring it on, God. It's my due. And if that happens, you know, God will need to test us to see what's in our heart. That's not something that we want to willingly enter into. We want to avoid that. And lastly, we can live right with God. We can be blessed in all of these ways. We can have our hearts in the work. But we can tell ourselves that we're doing properly by going out of our way to befriend those who, so that we help the wicked, so that we love those that hate God. Those are just some of the traps of pride. Some of the things mentioned here in these kings, these righteous kings of Judah, we can see those things, and there are plenty of other examples as well. But the overall lesson for us is that we have to always go to God humbly, asking that he guide us, that he give us humility. We need that. Without it, pride will blossom. And we need the wisdom to avoid developing pride. So these things we ask God for, and then we use that wisdom that he's given us. We won't turn there. Last verse here, Titus 3:2, it says, speak evil of no one, be peaceable, gentle, showing all humility to all men. Humbleness, that's the antidote to pride, and that's what we must have.